The views and opinions expressed during the drive time are those of Dave Glover and his guests and are not those of Northumberland 89.7. Agree, disagree, or have a comment? Call the station and speak with Dave live on the air. Call 905-372-2321. That's 905-372-2321. Now your host, Dave Glover.
And thank you very much, Wendy. The wonderful Wendy Galbraith, everybody. My guest on the line is Jim Stanford from Unifor. Rob Washburn is my co-host today. You have a follow-up question, sir.
Yeah, I did. When we were talking about minimum wage, one of the things that you didn't get to talk about fully was the role of the private sector and the role of the public sector in this formula of bringing about these changes. Can you talk a bit about that, about what happens when the private sector doesn't start creating jobs, or when we talk about minimum wage, and then what is the role of the public sector in that?
Right, sure. Well, I often come back to a very simple formula that I learned in my first year of economics. I studied at the University of Calgary with Stephen Harper, believe it or not. I studied economics there.
Was he a good student?
You know, I can't remember him, and I don't think I ever actually had a class with him. So I can't comment on what kind of a student he was, other than it's ironic that we were there together.
That is ironic, especially how there's clearly been a divergence of
viewpoints. Yeah, I'll say. Now, we learned that there's four main categories, if you like, or four potential engines of growth in our economy. And we summarized it in a formula, C plus I plus G plus X.
Mm-hmm.
And each of those stands for one of the main engines. Consumer spending is an important engine, as we were talking earlier. But consumers, in a way, can't lead the parade because they have to have a job that gives them some income in the first place.
Absolutely.
Before they go out and spend. You can borrow for a while, but that doesn't take you everywhere. So the other three are the ones that are really the leading forces. I stands for investment. This is business capital spending when companies decide to open or expand their operations. In doing so, they pump spending power through the economy, they create jobs, they hire people, and then you get the spin-off benefits. That's why business investment is so important to our economy, and the fact that business investment has performed terribly in Canada over the last decade, not just because of the oil price, it was already weak, is one of our main drawbacks. X stands for exports, of course. That is the produce that we sell, goods and services, to the rest of the world. And again, by doing that, we're pumping spending power into our economy from those foreign purchasers. And then if all else fails, you've got G. G stands for government. And these are the expenses that government pumps into the economy through their spending on hospitals, education facilities, infrastructure, other services, as well as transfer payments like pension funds. So generally, if things were going well, you'd have growth in investment, you'd have growth in exports, and you'd have growth in the government sector. And then all of those would underwrite very strong demand on the part of consumers. And, you know, we were talking about earlier times that were better, and Lester Pearson's time would have been one of them. You had all cylinders firing. You had government expanding its operations. You had exports that were booming, in part thanks to the auto pack. You had business investment that was very strong.
Mm-hmm.
So no wonder consumers were optimistic. Today, we don't really have an engine that's in gear. Investment has been falling. Our exports have been weak. We did get a good report this week, actually, for June exports. Finally, we're maybe seeing a bit of an uptick with the help of the lower dollar, but so far they've been weak. Consumers are tapped out, so that leaves G, the role of government. And in a time when everything else is weak, the last thing you want to do is make things even worse with your own spending cutbacks and shrinkage. But yet that's exactly what's happened. Mr. Harper's top priority in terms of policy has been to eliminate the deficit. So he's substantially, particularly since 2011, substantially cut back federal-level program spending. He's eliminated 50,000 jobs in the broader federal public sector, and so in a way, he's added to the overall weakness. In I think a more balanced approach would see a government trying to offset the weakness in the private sector and protect and stimulate some of the purchasing power that we need in the economy at any given point in time.
But doesn't that mean that some people react and say, But you're talking about my taxes going up when you talk about government intervention. It's going to cost money, and you're going to have to raise taxes here or raise taxes there. That's usually the type of response we get when we hear stuff like that. Isn't that true?
Well, it is certainly true that you have to pay some taxes. You don't have to eliminate a deficit at any given point in time, but over the long run, you have to have some stability in your overall public debt as a share of your GDP. You can actually help to pay the way. You can sort of grease the wheels a bit, if you like, with government programs that they benefit some of the spending and economic activity that happens in the private sector. And in that regard, offset some of the cost, not all of the cost, but some of the cost of a public program by stimulating that private activity, which in turn generates new revenues and generates new taxes for government. So it's not dollar for dollar, but the point is definitely fair that if we want to have a system in which a fair chunk of our total standard of living depends on public goods like healthcare, education, infrastructure, and so on, then a good chunk of our incomes in on balance are going to have to pay for those things.
So I have two questions that just popped into my head as you were speaking. But the first question, of course, we've all seen the conservative ad where they laugh at Justin Trudeau about budgets balancing themselves. Do budgets balance themselves, Jim? Can budgets balance themselves?
Well, that's such a little piece of kind of advertising rhetoric. I think what Mr. Trudeau was saying in the quote that has been clipped out and used a million times is that if the economy is booming and jobs are being created and incomes are rising, then people are automatically going to pay taxes as a result of that, and budget deficits will shrink. It is absolutely the case that deficits tend to grow when the economy is weak and shrink or disappear when the economy is strong. That is an automatic thing. So they're trying to make it sound ridiculous, but it's actually a core feature.
Well, the formula
of how macroeconomics works.
The formula you were just discussing there, the C plus I plus X plus G, I mean, if that's the formula that governments are supposed to use, it's basic economics, right? If that is the formula that's being used, if we use GDP versus GNP and come to an approximation of dollars in, dollars out, I mean, realistically, the budget should balance itself, right?
If the economy is strong, then the deficit is not going to be a problem. That is the thing. And I think what Mr. Trudeau was probably trying to say is, let's focus on getting a real recovery going. Let's focus on jobs being created and incomes growing and investments being made, instead of trying to dig our way out of a hole. I don't know if you've ever tried that, but if you try to dig your way out of a hole, the hole gets deeper. And that's what's happened with all of this, I would say, kind of knee-jerk austerity that we have seen in Canada and in other countries, even internationally. You look at the disaster that has unfolded in Greece, where initially the foreign bureaucrats were telling Greece, you have to cut, 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 cut. Well, when they cut, the biggest, deepest, longest-lasting cuts you can imagine. We've never experienced anything remotely like that in Canada. All that happened was the Greek economy was destroyed. Nobody had a job. Nobody had any income. Taxes fell even lower, and the debt got even bigger. So it was absolutely self-inflicted damage. And to a much, much, much milder degree, we've experienced the same problem here in Canada.
Well, that brings me to the second question, which was how much damage has the federal government's tax cut regime really been downloaded to the provinces? Because, of course, when they reduce the amount of money they're bringing in and then they reduce the services, the provinces have to pick up the freight, right?
Certainly that's true. And I think a sleeper issue in this federal campaign could very much be the issue of the transfer payments to the provinces for health care. You know, there was a thing that was called the Canada Health Accord the previous federal government had signed with the provinces. That expired this past year, and instead of negotiating a new plan with the provinces, the federal government just unilaterally said, well, we're going to cut back how much we're growing this this transfer by in terms of, you know, of course you have to spend more on health care over time due to inflation and population growth and the aging of society. They have cut back the rule to as low as 3% increases per year, which is going to mean a big hole in the budgets of provincial health care systems. That means one way or another Canadians are going to pay for that. It's a big piece of the federal government's balanced budget plan, yet we will have to pay for it either through increased taxes at the provincial level or through reductions in the quality of the service that we get from our healthcare system.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know there's been a lot of pushback from industry because, I mean, there was a report I read recently in the National Post that said industry is sitting on billions of dollars in cash that they're not willing to spend at this point because of the precarious nature of the economy. But how much of that is self-inflicted?
The private sector, non-financial corporations are now sitting on about $700 billion. That's incredible, $700 billion
mm-hmm.
of liquid assets. So this is money that they have received in after-tax profits. Their cash flow has grown, both because profits have risen, but also because taxes have been cut. The federal corporate tax has been cut by over a third, for example, since Stephen Harper was elected.
Mm-hmm.
So in theory, these tax cuts were supposed to stimulate stronger business investment.
Mm-hmm.
In practice, they have just added to that pile of idle cash. And the problem is, again, getting back to this formula, in terms of the recycling of spending power in our economy, if corporations are earning after-tax cash flow and not re-spending it, it's like you've got a leak in your bathtub. The spending power dissipates from the economy, and you end up with a much weaker overall employment and income situation.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be far better to have maintained the taxes where they were and then spent the money on public capital projects and infrastructure and so on. At least that way the money is getting re-injected into the economy. And the stimulative impact of the lower income tax on business investment location is invisible. If you look at the historical data,
mm-hmm.
you can't see a bounce in business investment because of the tax reduction.
Well, it's funny because one of the last things that I ever saw Jim Flaherty say, he was being interviewed on Amanda Lang, and he was talking about that very issue about how they're sitting on this cash. And one of the last things he said was, "If you don't spend it, we'll tax it so we can spend it." And that was Jim Flaherty basically saying, look, we gave you guys tax breaks. We gave you this. We told you we wanted you to stimulate the economy, hiring people. They haven't done that. So he said that the federal government was obviously going to have to look at a rethink on that particular policy. But as it stands right now, I mean, the average worker probably pays between 22 and 30% of their income to taxation.
Yes.
That's a fair number. But corporations on average, what is it, 8 to 13%? They're paying half. Canadian workers are subsidizing their own jobs, Jim.
That would be one way to look at it, for sure. The official federal tax rate is 15%, and then there's a provincial income tax that's levied on corporations, the level of which varies from one province to another.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, there's lots of write-offs and loopholes and deductions, so the effective rate paid by companies tends to be quite a bit lower than that. And I think there's only so much that can be done by taxing corporations. I don't think increasing the tax on companies alone will pay for much of what we need. We're going to have to pay some taxes ourselves through,
mm-hmm.
I think, a fair income tax system and so on. But it certainly, I think, has made things incrementally worse that you've got $15 billion a year now is the cost of the Harper corporate tax cuts. And it's just leaking out of the economy. It isn't being re-injected, and that's,
mm-hmm.
that's a problem.
One of the things that we talked about earlier was the foreign trade agreements that are being negotiated and have been negotiated on our behalf. And I'm just wondering, you know, can you help provide us with some context and some understanding about these deals, in particular the Trans-Pacific deal that's suddenly been pushed up in the mainstream media, about how that's going to impact us and what are some of the things that we should be asking at the door of our candidates about this deal and about trade?
Well, I wish I could shed some light on it, but unfortunately, these Trans-Pacific talks have been occurring entirely in secret. I do believe that business lobbyists and some business leaders in Canada have been in on the discussions and are aware of what's going on, but the public as a whole has been kept in the dark. So there's a lot of confusion. Really, the only aspect of the TPP that's generated a lot of discussion and interest in Canada has been this issue about our dairy and poultry marketing boards,
mm-hmm.
That the other countries want Canada to get rid of. And that would cause a lot of, I think, dislocation in farming communities in Quebec and Ontario.
Well, not to mention the health concerns. I mean, I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but currently 100% of the milk produced in the United States contains a bovine growth hormone to increase milk production. That's another Monsanto product.
Yes.
And it's a known carcinogen. This is a product that actually causes
right.
cancer. There's been links to cancer. We have it banned here in Canada. It's banned in Great Britain. And yet, with the new TPP, does that mean Canadians are going to be buying tainted milk?
Well, we don't know. That's the problem. Because of the details are all being negotiated in secret, we don't understand what the deal will mean in terms of our ability to require inspection, to require labeling of the food that's imported. We do know that, you know, factory farms in the United States and some other jurisdictions can sure turn out a lot of beef and a lot of dairy products,
mm-hmm.
but the conditions are often very questionable. Whereas in Canada, the one benefit of that system that we have is it has helped to preserve more stability, if you like, in the kind of family farming end of things.
But haven't we also seen, though, a real concerted effort to undermine supply management systems in this country? I mean, since over this government's time, we've watched the wheat board slowly being filed away. And now with these trade deals, again, it seems like, again, the supply management systems are going to be threatened.
I think that's fair, and we do know that there's no love lost between the government, the Harper government, and that whole agricultural marketing system. They are the ones that abolished the Canadian Wheat Board, for example, and eliminated mm-hmm. that system as it used to apply to grain farming. Right now, they're being pretty tight-lipped on what they would do with the poultry and dairy sectors, mostly for cold, hard political reasons. You know, those two sectors have a lot of votes in some ridings in Quebec and Ontario that are very
mm-hmm.
important. Also in British Columbia, by the way, very important to the Harper election strategy. So they are not indicating what they will do to supply management. I think they would prefer to not talk about it, to keep it secret until after the election, and that's when they would make the same concessions here. Philosophically, they are completely opposed to the whole idea. So we can't rely on this government to try and protect what's left of that system. And you're quite right to point out that it would open up some risks for consumers as well as for the producers
mm-hmm.
of those products.
Well, you know, earlier I mentioned the Rocco Galati interview on Amanda Lang. And, of course, Rocco Galati and his client Comer are trying to force the federal government to adhere to the laws of the land, especially as it pertains to the Bank Act and the role of the Bank of Canada. You know, you talked about the growth under Lester Pearson. That growth was available because they were able to get interest-free loans from the Bank of Canada. Is that something the government should be rethinking, Jim? Should the government be looking at this idea of rather than borrowing from foreign institutions at high rates of interest, since we own our own bank, we're the only country in the world that does, should we not just be utilizing our own bank?
I think there's a lot of potential to think about using public banks even more generally, not just the Bank of Canada, but there's other public banks or non-profit banks that could be used. Canada, for example, has the Business Development Bank. It has an outfit called Export Development Canada, which in essence is a bank.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we could learn a lot from other countries which have used development banks or state banks as a tool for financing investments in both public infrastructure, but also private businesses, helping to capitalize and partner with domestic companies to get more of that investment money flowing, as we talked about. Right now, interest costs are not the federal government's problem. Interest rates are incredibly low.
Mm-hmm.
The government can borrow money on commercial markets for virtually free in real terms. The interest rate that they're paying now is just above 2%, which is barely enough to keep up with the inflation.
That's still 2% more than zero at the Bank of Canada, though.
Yes, or paying interest to yourself by borrowing money from
mm-hmm.
yourself. So I think there is definitely some potential to explore that avenue. We've seen the Americans and the British and the Japanese and others experiment with this whole process called quantitative easing,
mm-hmm.
Which in essence is a very similar way of creating purchasing power out of thin air to get economic activity going. So far in Canada, the Bank of Canada has steered clear of that, but I think that it's something that they should definitely build into their repertoire.
Isn't there a stark difference, though, between a bank that you own yourself and a foreign entity?
Oh, certainly.
I mean, the Bank of America or the U.S. Federal Reserve is a foreign. I mean, it's a privately owned bank. The Bank of England, a privately owned bank. Canada is the only bank, only country in the world that actually owns its our own bank. So the question I put to people is, if you needed to get a new roof on your house and you owned your own bank, would you just borrow from your own bank, or would you go to an institution and borrow the money with interest?
That's a good analogy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? I think we've gone through the whole mill here. Anything we should be looking forward to tonight during the upcoming debates for those people that are able to watch it anyway?
Yeah, it's going to be a long campaign, and I sympathize with the Canadian voters. I'm going to have a hard time myself keeping my attention up for 77 days of this. But I do think it's incumbent on all of us to have a really stark look at, you know, what's happened to Canada over the last decade, what has happened, what hasn't happened, how people's living standards have been affected. And most Canadians are not better off than they were a decade ago. Mm-hmm. Many of them are worse off.
Well, that's the old question Ronald Reagan asked, remember?
That's right, yeah. And I think this election campaign will be decided by economic issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that the traditional assumption that conservatives know how to manage the economy better is absolutely demonstrably false, given our historical experience. And Canadians should take a hard look at that before they vote.
Is it fair to say that whomever forms the next government is going to have to raise taxes? I mean, if we're going to be able to cover the nut, as they say, whoever gets elected, I mean, it's my opinion anyway, that we're either going to have to see a complete revamping of the taxation process, which the Liberals and the Conservatives are already talking about. The Liberals are saying they want to have a fairer tax regime. Is it fair to say, though, that whomever forms the next government is really being handed a hot potato?
Well, I think they are being handed a hot potato in the sense that the tax cuts which the government has put in place over the last decade, including these ones that they've just rushed through, right? They're really trying to buy their way back into office with these tax cuts, make it harder for future governments to pay for the services and infrastructure that Canada needs. Now, you know, does that require across-the-board tax increases immediately after? I tend to think not. I think if we had a very aggressive job creation strategy that got people working again, you get huge fiscal benefits from that without having to affect tax rates. But in some areas, I think that closing loopholes or increasing the corporate income tax rate, imposing some higher taxes on the top 1% that have done very well, those can be a part of the solution for sure.
Well, absolutely. My guest has been Jim Stanford. He is the economist for Unifor, the new union formed in 2013 with the merger of the CAW and the Communication Energy Paper Workers. Unifor represents over 300,000 members in over 20 economic sectors. Jim's received his PhD in economics in 95 from the New School of Social Research in New York and holds an economics degree from the Cambridge University as well as University of Calgary. He's an author of Economics for Everyone, which is a book I would urge everyone to read, which has been translated into six languages. He writes an economics column for the Globe and Mail, which we read on a regular basis here at the Drive Time, and he is a member of CBC's regular National News Economics Panel, The Bottom Line. He lives in Toronto with his partner and two daughters. Jim, thank you very much for joining us. We'd like to make you a regular guest here. Any chance we can get you back?
Oh, absolutely. It was a pleasure talking with you today, Dave and Rob. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us. And thanks, listeners, for tuning in. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to pay some bills in just a few minutes, so we will be right back with more of our conversation with Rob Washburn. And you've been listening to The Drive Time right here on Northumberland 89.7. I'm Dave Glover. Rob Washburn, my co-host for the day. We'll be right back.